Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we get into it today, I just wanted to send my condolences to the Foo Fighters. When I woke up this morning, when this was being recorded, at least, Taylor Hawkins, the drummer for the Foo Fighters, was announced to have died Friday, which is a very sad thing. The Foo Fighters were a good band. I haven't always been a fan of theirs, and to be quite honest, I'm not really a huge fan still. I do like some of their songs, and it's always tragic when someone, well, he wasn't young, but Taylor was 50, and it's always sad when someone that's talented dies. So my condolences to the Foo Fighters and Taylor Hawkins' family. So last week, I did the first part of an episode where I talked about some movies that fucking suck and that you should definitely stay the fuck away from. This week, I decided that I would talk about some movies that you've probably never heard of and are highly underrated, but you should definitely take some time to investigate and watch. So let's jump right into it with the horror comedy of 2008's Otis.
Thinkable happens.
Good evening, sir.
Who is this?
A boy in school. I know your daughter.
When the law can't help you.
You have a lead on him, right?
No.
One grieving family, hoping against hope that their little girl isn't dead.
When somebody must pay.
What do we need to do to make sure that Kim stays alive?
Just let me take her to the prom.
All you can do is turn to your family.
Prom night, you son of a bitch.
I'm a criminologist trained to hunt down today's modern day monsters. What's the ETA on the cappuccino machine? Where are we going? You should feel good now. I have an 80% recovery rate.
80%? Really?
Well, we only recovered 60% of Debbie Pilter.
Right. Beautiful legs. Drag star.
And the desperate manhunt continues for a killer known only by a voice on the phone.
You really think that this pig deserves due process, Will? Now, please, go get some power tools.
You can't keep doing this.
You need a girl.
I'm gonna pick you up in the old Trans Am, and it's gonna be magical.
A night to dismember.
I thought your dad could cut his fingers and toes off, and we could blend them into a smoothie and make him drink it.
Think it outside the box, Mom. I like it.
She's got it. Yeah, baby, she's got it.
It's so hard. Can't she just fall along?
In the middle of a serial abductor slash serial killer's rampage, a young, beautiful teen, Riley Lawson, goes missing. When her desperate parents, Will and Kate, are contacted by her kidnapper, an annoying FBI special agent takes charge of the case. But from deep within the psychopathic subterranean world created by Otis, the serial killer, Riley turns the tables on her tormentor, manages to escape, and to contact her parents. Fed up with the inability of the FBI to find their girl, Will, Kate, and Riley's brother, Reed, decide to take matters and justice into their own hands in a hilariously bloody ending. One of the movies that was released on the Raw Feed series, this movie went under the radar of a lot of horror fans, and that's a shame because this is really a pretty good fucking movie. It's full of great, dark, funny lines that just keep coming at you relentlessly. And the entire cast does an excellent job, especially Howard Stern, not the shock DJ, but Howard Stern, the actor who you might recognize from the first two Home Alone movies, the first Chud, I believe he was in Stripes and a bunch of other movies. They all do a very good job. The story is kind of stupid and kind of derivative, but it still works within the context of this movie. And like I said, it went under the radar of a lot of horror fans, which I think is a shame because it really is worth the watch. It's funny, it has some gore, and it's all around a good time when you watch it. IMDb gave this a 6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 75%. Letterboxd a 2.8 out of 5. And I give it a 4 out of 5. Next up, we have 2015's Green Room.
Okay, I'm with the 8 Rights from Washington, D.C. You guys are hard to find. Why no social media presence?
The music is shared live. It's time and regression. You gotta be there.
Sorry, guys. Gotta clear up. Follow me.
And then it's over. Holy shit.
I told you to follow. Stop!
No! 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 No!
You can't keep us here. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. You're just staying.
We're so fucking dead, guys.
What do we do? Oh, shit.
This will be over soon, gentlemen.
What are they doing?
They're coming.
We gotta go.
And we die.
How long can we wait? For sure that is.
Is that a pep talk? Just grab some shit, get ready to run.
Here we go.
I see a man on the horizon. I see trouble on the way.
They're everywhere!
You breathing? Let him bleed.
Careful now.
I can't die here.
So don't.
It's fucking hard, man.
The Ain't Rights, a punk band from D.C., Pat, Sam, Reese, and Tiger are traveling the Pacific Northwest low on funds. After their gig is canceled, a radio host arranges a new show in a rural area outside Portland through his cousin Daniel. Arriving at the venue, they realize it's a neo-Nazi skinhead bar and they're opening for an NSBM band, Cowcatcher. They go ahead with the show anyway, and during their set, Pat notes two young women, Emily and Amber, looking disturbed and being shepherded out of sight. As the band is about to leave, Pat returns to the bar's green room to retrieve Sam's cell phone, where he stumbles upon Amber and the members of Cowcatcher standing over the body of Emily, who has been stabbed to death by Worm. Pat calls the police as he flees, but is caught and bar employees Gabe and Big Justin capture the rest of the band and confine them in the green room with Amber. Gabe pays one young skinhead to stab another to create a cover story for the police, who respond to Pat's call. He consults with the bar's owner, skinhead leader Darcy, played pretty chillingly by Patrick Stewart, who decides all witnesses need to be eliminated. He arranges for Cowcatcher to be gifted poisoned heroin, while more skinheads assemble at the bar, waiting until nightfall to kill the band and Amber. The band manages to overpower Big Justin and hold him hostage, taking his pistol and a box cutter from his pocket. They negotiate through the door with Darcy, who asks them to surrender the pistol. Pat agrees on the condition that they keep the bullets, but when he opens the door, the men attempt to force their way in while slashing at his arm. They manage to close the door, however, Pat loses a gun and is seriously injured. Big Justin then attempts to break free, leading Reese to choke him unconscious, and in response, Amber slashes his stomach open with the box cutter. The band then tears up the floorboards and discovers a drug lab underneath the bar, but the only exit is locked from the outside. Arming themselves with improvised weapons, they attempt to fight their way out. Neo-Nazi Clark unleashes a fighting dog which kills Tiger, and Amber and Pat drive the dog away with microphone feedback. Reese escapes through a window, only to be stabbed to death by Alan, and Pat, Amber, and Sam retreat back to the green room. Daniel arrives, and Darcy sends him in to kill the remaining survivors, claiming they murdered Emily, his girlfriend. However, he instead talks to them, and Amber explains that Worm murdered Emily after discovering she and Daniel were planning to leave the skinhead life. Daniel agrees to help them escape, but as they venture back out into the bar, he is shot dead by the bartender. Pat then kills the bartender, and the group takes a shotgun, only to find themselves confronted by the full skinhead force. Sam then mortally wounds Clark's dog with the shotgun before it kills her, and Amber is shot as she and Pat once again retreat to the green room. With the sun rising soon, Darcy has most of the skinheads disperse, taking Clark and Alan with him to stage the band's deaths to make it look as if they were killed while trespassing on his property. Gabe prepares to clean up the bar, while Jonathan and Kyle are dispatched with the dog to finish off Pat and Amber, who formulate a plan for a last stand. They again use microphone feedback to scare off the dog before Pat lures Jonathan into the drug lab. As Kyle stands watching the green room, Amber emerges from under the cushions of the couch and ambushes him, cutting his throat with the box cutter. Pat and Jonathan fight, and Amber sneaks up and shoots Jonathan in the back of the head. Gabe then enters the green room to find his companions dead, and surrenders to Pat and Amber. Holding Gabe at gunpoint, they trek through the woods, and as they near Darcy's house, Pat and Amber decide to go after him, while Gabe goes to a nearby farm to call the authorities. Pat and Amber kill Clark and Alan before confronting Darcy. Fleeing, Darcy pulls a revolver, but is shot dead, their ammunition and energy spent. Pat and Amber sit on the side of the road, waiting for the police as sirens are heard in the distance, and the movie ends. This is another excellent movie that went under the radar of a lot of horror fans, and it is severely underrated. It's not a straight-out horror movie. It's more of a suspense slash action slash thriller slash horror movie than a straight-up horror. It may not be one of the best movies I've ever seen, but it is one of the most entertaining and thrilling ones by far. That's for certain. It kind of has a slow beginning, but it's really just letting you meet and build up the characters. It has some pretty good gore, and it has become somewhat notorious due to the violence shown on screen. And I kind of think that's what turns a lot of people off to this movie. But if you've got the stomach for it, then you're going to be in for a treat. But unlike Saw or a lot of other gore movies, the violence shown here isn't just showing violence for a shock factor, but it uses it to keep the viewer off guard and not knowing where the next violent twist is going to come from. And there are also some pretty brutal deaths, but all of them happen for a reason. Unlike a lot of gore movies where it's just gore for the sake of gore. Not saying that this is a gore movie, but a lot of the action in it is fairly gory. The entire cast does a good job. Anton Yelchin, who in turn would die a pretty weird fucking death a year or so later, I think. I can't remember exactly when he died. But if you don't know about his death, look it up. Patrick Stewart does a surprising role change and plays a bad guy for once, and he does an excellent and chilling job. And this movie kind of reminds me of a cross, I guess, kind of between American History X and Don't Breathe, if you can picture those two movies put together. It's definitely worth a watch. You won't be disappointed. This had a budget of $5 million, but was considered a flop, since it only brought in $3.8 million at the box office. And like I said, I think that why it didn't do so good as a horror movie, it's because it's a combination of like four different genres, sorry. And I don't think people really knew what to make of it, but like I said, it's definitely well worth the watch. IMDb rated it a 7 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 90%. Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5. And I give it, once again, a 4 out of 5. And that brings us into 2020's VFW.
Lord. Oh, there you go. You've been at this, haven't you?
I have.
Uh-huh.
To us. Still here.
Still here. You know where you are, kid? In the VFW post.
How about we close the bar down early tonight?
What do you got going on?
The best birthday that Freddy ever got.
Lizard! Hey, this is Carl! Oh.
It's Q&A time, kid. You see, the problem is that me and my old friends are probably going to die tonight unless you help us out to understand what's happening here. You steal this?
Foz killed my sister, all right? This, though, it's all he's got, his whole life.
VFW. What is that?
Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Good. Soldiers are good at dying. There's only one satisfactory solution, and that is we get our product back and each of you die.
You were a soldier. So are we all. Let's act like it. We set a perimeter. We make our stand.
You'll all die very, very slowly. You last.
But what are we gonna do? Do it.
Because you make a mistake. I'm gonna cut your heart out.
You and me both know this ain't the only option. We can push Miss Teen USA right back out to the way she came in.
It's for you that we're doing all of this.
Hey, I never asked for your goddamn help, Gramps.
The second you walked through that door, we was duty bound to help you.
Let's go.
Boz is the leader of a psychotic gang dealing with a powerful and addictive new drug called Hype. His members, dubbed Hypers, are completely hooked on his product, so much so that he makes one of the members, Lucy, jump off a balcony to her death after he drops a baggie of Hype off of it. Lucy's younger sister, Elizabeth, nicknamed Lizard, witnesses this and steals Boz's stash to get even while fleeing from Boz when he catches her in the process. Meanwhile, Fred Paris, an Army veteran from the Vietnam War, meets up with his friend Abe Hawkins, where they go to Fred's bar, a VFW, or aka Veterans of Foreign Wars bar, hang out, where they meet up with their old Army friends Walter Reed, Lou Clayton, Thomas Z. Zabriskie, and Doug McCarthy. The friends wish to celebrate Fred's birthday, much to his chagrin, and relive their glory days. They are joined later by young Army Ranger Sean Mason, who is on leave to see his wife. The night turns chaotic, however, when Lizard enters the bar and Boz's brother Rhodey hacks off one of Doug's arms with an axe. Fred and the veterans fight off Rhodey and his men, with Fred killing Rhodey with a sawed-off shotgun. Wanting to get Doug medical help, Z and Fred try to flee to Z's truck, only for Boz's right-hand woman, Gutter, to slice open Z's neck with her machete. Fred and Walter attempt to get to the truck again, but Gutter sneaks up on Fred, begins strangling him with a chain, demanding him to give it back, but Fred survives by stabbing Gutter with the truck keys and returns to the bar. He demands Lizard to tell the truth about her and the attacks, but she keeps her mouth shut. Lou later finds out why they are being attacked after finding the backpack with the stolen stash in a toilet tank and wishes to make a deal with Boz. Lizard, however, says that because they killed Rhodey, Boz will never let them live, and the only option the veterans have is to defend themselves against the Hypers. They prepare makeshift weapons from the bar's furniture and traps reminiscent of those they used in the Vietnam War. The veterans are then put through hell. When Boz's hypers, including the hulking member Tank, break into the barricaded bar, giving them a bloody battle. Lou, having reached his breaking point, decides to make a deal with Boz to save himself and his friends. But Boz does not comply and decides to shoot and kill Lou, but not before Lou takes out more of Boz's men. Fred, who chased after Lou, is shot in the leg by Boz and becomes depressed after Lou's death and Doug finally dying after the blood loss from his wounds. He starts drinking in the back room from the guilt till Lizard snaps him out of it, reminding him how his remaining friends need him, including her. Fred and the veterans decide to make a last stand against Boz, who has had enough of the veterans killing his men and running out of time with Don approaching. The hypers then blow up the barricade and demand the product back, giving Fred a no-way-out ultimatum. But Fred refuses to give up after everything they put him and the others through, and shoots one of the bricks of hype in the air, causing Boz's hypers, who inhaled the drug, to go crazy and attack everyone, including Boz and Gutter. The veterans then begin fighting back. Abe, who has taken a hit of hype to get himself mentally prepared, begins slicing up the hypers with his old service machete to allow the others to flee. Walter then steals a chainsaw, and with Sean's help, they get to the vet's old gun truck to escape, but are ambushed with Walter taking a mortal wound to his shoulder. Abe then battles Gutter, who gets the upper hand, wounding him, but dies when Fred rams a broken flagpole through her body and the other piece through her head. Lizard was caught by Boz earlier during the fight and forces her back to his car, but Fred retrieves his shotgun and remaining ammo and shoots Boz in the back as well as the backpack, which he had earlier soaked with his alcohol, catching it on fire, which allows Lizard to escape. Walter, who is barely hanging on, orders Sean to leave him so he can see his wife again, with Walter ramming the gun truck at Boz, causing both the gun truck and Boz's escape vehicle to explode, killing them both. Fred, Sean, and Lizard then return to the bar with an exhausted Abe waiting, where they pour shots for their fallen friends, now including Abe, who succumbed to his injuries after receiving his shot glass. Fred then finds a block of hype hiding behind his counter, with Lizard commenting the money he will get with it will repair the bar and more, realizing Lizard hid it there on purpose to thank Fred for everything he did for her. The three then consume their drinks, with Sean telling Fred happy birthday, and the movie ends. This is a fun, neat little movie that has a great cast, which involves Stephen Lang, William Sadler, Fred Williamson, I think his name is, and a bunch of others. I will admit, not a lot in this movie makes a whole lot of sense, but why should it? It's just supposed to be a big, dumb, loud throwback to the 80s action/horror movies. It may not be that original of a story, but once again, it's definitely worth watching. And it's a fun little watch to go or to sit through. You won't be bored at all. And just at 92 minutes, it doesn't overstay its welcome at all. IMDb rated it a 6.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes an 83%. Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3.8 out of 5. And next up, we have 2006's Cold Prey.
Vi vet dere vil finne gutten deres. Men han som har forsvunnet?
Hva
I guess you couldn't really tell what this movie is about, since I didn't realize that the entire trailer was going to be in fucking Norwegian, even though I knew it was a Norwegian movie. So, my apologies. The movie opens with a young boy with a large birthmark covering one eye, running frantically through a blizzard in Jotunheim, being pursued by an unknown entity. Eventually, he stumbles, and his unseen pursuer catches up to him, and despite his pleas, the person proceeds to bury him alive in the snow. Years later, a young group of friends consisting of Janik, her boyfriend Eric, and their friends Michael, Ingun, and Morten Tobias are going on a snowboarding vacation in Jotunheim. They drive to a secluded area in the mountains to avoid the crowds, and when they arrive at the peak, they immediately begin snowboarding down the mountain slopes. Morten Tobias suddenly takes a bad fall and breaks his leg. Janik takes charge and sets his leg, but realizes they cannot care for it properly out in the elements. They also have no cell reception, and the car is too far away to get to before dark. Wandering over a hill, they spot a lodge and decide to seek help there. When they get to the lodge, Eric discovers that the place is deserted. He breaks in through a window and unlocks the door. And as Janik looks for medical supplies, she comes across a box that contains superglue and a single shotgun shell. Janik treats Morten's broken leg with alcohol and the superglue, while Eric, Michael, and Ingun go to explore the abandoned resort, and Janik stays to keep Morten company. The three discover the generator, which Eric fixes, and power is restored to the resort. Afterwards, Michael and Ingun run off by themselves, and while exploring the various lodge suites, they discover a room in disarray with the bed burnt to cinders. Eric, on his way back to the parlor, hears a clanking noise from down in the cellar and assumes it is Michael and Ingun. He calls for them to be more careful, but receives no reply. With the lights back on, music playing, and plentiful amounts of food and alcohol, the group relaxes in the parlor. Janik finds the hotel's guestbook and discovers that the last guest checked in sometime in 1975, and there is a message reading, "We hope you find your son." Inside the book, there is a picture of a family that includes a boy with a birthmark over his eye. The group then settles in for the night with Michael and Ingun running off to a suite, Janik and Eric cuddling under blankets in a parlor, and Morten Tobias alone on the couch. Making out in the bed, Michael begins to get aggressive, and Ingun shoves him off. He then leaves in a huff, and Ingun hears a strange noise, and thinking it is Michael returning, enters the hall. She is suddenly attacked by an unknown shape and runs through the hall screaming for help, but is drowned out by the music playing in the parlor. Before she can reach Michael, who is sitting at the bar, she is stabbed by a pickaxe and dragged away. Next morning, Eric leaves to go for help, and Michael heads to the suite to apologize to Ingun. Eric stumbles across Ingun's body in the snow, and is then smashed in the head by the blunt end of the pickaxe. Michael gets no answer from Ingun, so he and Janik explore the basement. They find items that were invented long after the lodge closed in the 1970s, and begin to get nervous. Janik goes to talk to Ingun and enters the suite to discover it is covered in blood. She then brings Michael and Morten Tobias to the suite just as a blast of wind flows through the hallway from an open door. They then realize someone else is in the lodge and barricade themselves in an empty suite. Footsteps are heard in the hall and someone begins to slam against the door, trying to get in, and when they eventually leave, Michael tells Janik they should run. She points out that Morten Tobias cannot, and Michael says they should just leave him. Janik refuses, and Michael escapes through a window. And Janik and Morten Tobias watch through the window as Michael hides in a shed. Suddenly, a massive mountain man appears outside wearing animal skins and goggles, and he enters the shed, and Michael tries to run, but becomes stuck in a bear trap, and the mountain man breaks Michael's neck. Janik then drags Morten Tobias to a pantry and tells him to memorize the label on the can until she gets back, and she narrowly misses being spotted by the mountain man as he drags Michael's body inside. Janik runs to the shed where she finds some skis, a sled, and a shotgun, and runs into the parlor where she picks up the discarded shotgun shell and loads a gun. She goes back to the pantry and tells Morten Tobias that she has a plan. They go down to the basement where Janet killed the kills the generator, alerting the Mountain Man to their whereabouts. Martin Tobias then finds a box cutter and puts it in his pocket. Janet waits for the Mountain Man to appear so she can shoot him, but discovers the keys she gave Eric on the floor, and when she enters the back room, she finds Eric tied up but alive. Unable to free him, she goes back to wait for the Mountain Man, and when he appears, he goes straight into the back room. Janet then points a gun at him, but he shuts off his flashlight and disappears into the darkness. Thinking quickly, Janet shuts the door and locks him in the back room, but refuses to leave him in there with Eric. Opening the door, she shoots, but is knocked over by Martin Tobias, who realizes that Mountain Man is using Eric as a human shield. The Mountain Man then impales Eric with his pickaxe, killing him. Martin Tobias then tells Janet to run. He tries to stop the Mountain Man with the saw, but to no avail, and the Mountain Man kills him. Janet then grabs her skis and runs outside into the darkness, only to be knocked out by the Mountain Man. When she awakes, she is on the sled, buried under her dead friends. The Mountain Man brings them to a deep ravine and begins tossing the bodies over to the side one by one. Janet grabs the box cutter out of Martin Tobias' pocket and lies still, and is the last to be dragged off the sled, and as the Mountain Man grabs her, she stabs him in the neck with the box cutter. They struggle over the pickaxe and end up on the ground by the edge of the ravine. As the Mountain Man is about to stab Janet, she rips off his goggles, revealing a birthmark over his eye, and taken by surprise, the Mountain Man lets his guard down. Janet then grabs his pickaxe and stabs him in the stomach, sending him over the edge of the ravine. Then, in a flashback, we see the Mountain Man as a boy running from his pursuer. As he is covered in the snow, he looks up to see the faces of his parents burying him alive. The Mountain Man then hits the bottom of the ravine, surrounded by the bodies of Janik's friends, and Janet, exhausted, collapses into the snow. Followed by two sequels, this is probably the best out of the three movies, even though the other two aren't that terrible. This is massively cliched and derivative in about every single manner you can think of American slasher horror movies, but just because I said that doesn't mean that this isn't a good movie, because it is a good movie. It's kind of a struggle to watch, because you have to deal with English subtitles, because the entire movie is in Norwegian. And it kind of, having to read what's being said kind of distracts from what's going on in the movie. But that's only really a small flaw when the rest of this movie is pretty decent, even though, like I said, it's pretty cliched. But in a big difference from this Norwegian slasher to American slashers, is that you actually care about the leads. They're not just cannon fodder that you really don't give a shit about what happens to. You actually give a shit about the characters in this movie. And that's something that the Norwegians do a lot better than we do when it comes to slasher films. This is a nice little updating of the whole slasher genre. Jesus Christ, I can't fucking speak today. But anyway, you should definitely see this. IMDb gave it a 6.3 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes an 84%. Letterboxd a 3 out of 5. And I give it a 3.5 out of 5. Next up is 2016's The Cleanse.
Who's ready to change their lives today?
Join us.
Welcome.
As you try a brand new program and face your demons today.
So much. And now,
your cleansing kit.
Each kit contains 4 drinks, which you must consume by the end of the day. The next stage will be the elimination process.
Question, when you say elimination process, you mean like...
Right? Yes, Harry.
The cleanse you drank has expelled all the negativity from your life. And put it into what you see before you.
Something came out of me.
That's perfectly normal.
What am I supposed to do?
What the hell is that?
You haven't seen your...
I know this can be a scary process.
You wouldn't believe what came out of me.
Don't you want to get better?
It was smaller at first.
Once you finish this, will be a beautiful thing.
Depressed and disappointed with his life after losing his job and his fiancée at the same time, Paul Berger attends a selection seminar for Let's Get Pure, a secretive self-help program created by Ken Roberts. At the selection meeting, Paul takes an interest in fellow applicant Maggie Jameson, and Paul is selected for the program's purification retreat. He is hesitant to sign a liability waiver that mentions the possibility of death, but agrees to participate after learning that Maggie was selected as well. Paul is then escorted by car to the retreat's secluded woodland location. There, he meets Fredericks, who has been participating in the program for several weeks. Paul and Maggie also learn that 2 other applicants, Eric and his girlfriend Lori, were selected to join the retreat. Lily conducts the program. Each of the new participants is given 4 personally formulated cleanse drinks that they are to consume before the end of the first day. Because of their horrible taste, Lori is unable to finish her 4th drink while everyone else completes the first stage of cleansing. Paul gets sick during the night and throws up in the sink. The next day, a small creature emerges from the sink's drainpipe. The creature grows as time goes by. Paul ends up nurturing his creature, realizing it is a physical manifestation of the negativity he purged from his system. Maggie tries to leave the camp when she first confronts her creature, but Lily convinces her to stay. Eric then spends time with his creature while Lori is bedridden with an illness from having not completed her cleanse. Meanwhile, Paul discovers Fredericks in battle with his creature, which has grown into a more monstrous form with time in Frederick's cabin. But Frederick insists that the situation is under control. Maggie then asks Paul to help understand her creature as it seemingly refuses to bond with her. The two of them discover that their creatures are drawn to each other and also reflect their individual characteristics. Eric ends up drinking Lori's last cleanse drink, and his creature tries to eat itself. Meanwhile, Paul and Maggie continue getting to know one another, and Paul's creature unexpectedly bites his finger. Ken Roberts then arrives at the camp. Paul and Maggie are summoned to meet him, and Ken interrupts his admonishment of Eric for not following instruction to force Maggie into personal reflection. At the conclusion of their conversation, Ken gives Maggie a blade and instructs her to kill her creature to complete the cleanse, but Maggie is unable to do so. Maggie then runs into the woods. Against Ken's demand, Paul takes his creature as well as Maggie's and goes after her. Paul then finds Eric in his cabin grieving over Lori's dead body. Horrified, Paul finds Maggie and explains that they need to leave immediately, but Ken and Lily catch up to confront Paul and Maggie. Ken says he will allow them to leave, but insists that they turn over their creatures. Paul then takes Ken's car keys and continues fleeing. Fredericks is killed by his creature, and while Paul drives away, Maggie checks on the 2 creatures in the back seat and discovers them having merged into 1 monster. Maggie is then bitten, causing Paul to swerve and crash. When Paul regains consciousness, he sees Maggie trying to kill the fused creature by bludgeoning it to death with a rock. Paul screams for her to stop before reluctantly realizing it must be killed for their own good. With tears in her eyes, Paul and Maggie strangle the creature with their bare hands, embrace, and the movie ends. The only thing that really might turn people off about this movie is that it's got a rather slow start. Actually, it's a very slow start. It's a pretty slow burner. And it's kind of a bizarre story. But not as bizarre as the next movie I'm going to get into, which it's very similar to. But it's just kind of a really odd story and kind of an odd premise. The acting is good and effects are decent enough, even though the creatures are kind of rubbery looking. But it's still a good movie. It's a decent enough time passer. But it's not nearly as good as the movies I've already talked about in this episode. IMDb gave it a 5.2 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 79%. Letterboxd 1.5 out of 5. And I give it a 3 out of 5. Next up we have 2013's very similar Bad Milo.
What is it? Lump in your colon is due to poor stress management.
We love seeing you guys, but we want grandkids.
Learn to relax.
It's been a crazy couple of weeks of work.
I just want you to be straight with them.
Hey, you want me to fire this guy today?
You'll do fine.
Oh. Oh.
Again with your damn stuff.
Shut up and eat your damn dinner, son.
I hate you.
I'm pregnant. Oh.
Into a corner by someone.
I've looked on your computer. I think I may have deleted something important.
What?
This creature comes out and attacks that someone. This thing is a part of you.
What are you talking about?
It's a metaphor.
This is the furthest thing from a metaphor.
Oh my God, what is it?
Wow. Stomach flu?
Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm knocking,
but no one's home.
What do we do?
Bond with it.
And if I do, it won't hurt anybody else.
Hopefully.
Milo?
Milo? I had a much better name.
A man named Duncan lives with his wife, Sarah, who constantly worries about his stress. One day, he schedules an appointment with a gastroenterologist after experiencing a rather serious level of gastric stress the night before. During the appointment, the doctor and nurse spot a large polyp in his intestinal tract. After seeing a large amount of stress at a very fast pace from work with his boss, placing him in charge of firing employees, where a man his age is in a relationship with his mother, and his wife is making him see a very eccentric therapist who keeps asking about his father issues, something unusual happens. The polyp forms into a 2-foot-tall sentient being and begins killing each person the creature sees as a source of stress with each day. And, unpleasantly, it comes out of Duncan's ass. The local news reports the attacks as having been committed by a rabid raccoon. Duncan's therapist informs him that the creature is a living manifestation of his life's stress built up over time, and that mythology of this type of being states that the best way to eliminate it is to bond with it so it doesn't act so irrationally. In an effort to bond with it, Duncan names this strange anal-dwelling creature Milo. First, Milo kills his coworker, then the ED doctor he didn't need, yet who wouldn't stop calling him. Soon enough, Milo kills Duncan's boss in an elevator during an investigation by the FBI at his office at his office building, and when it finally attacks his father, who apparently had a being of the same species, and begins killing the other being, Duncan loses his grip and moves Milo and himself to a hotel room far away, someplace safe. This doesn't work, however, and much as it seems to at the outset, and Milo tracks Sarah down to her house party, where a violent battle ensues between Duncan and Milo. Ultimately, Duncan dismembers Milo's left arm and legs, and finally saves its life, vowing to never ignore Milo's important influence and make amends with Milo, successfully doing so before Sarah reinserts Milo back up Duncan's ass. Ultimately, Milo's bloodline is discovered to be carried on through Duncan's unborn son, and the embryo of the new creature being seen in the system of the unborn fetus as the movie ends. Now, this one is quite bizarre, even more so than The Cleanse. With, like I've said, you know, the title creature Milo manifesting itself in from Duncan's stress and coming out of his asshole to kill people that Milo sees as a cause of stress in Duncan's life. I mean, it's kind of gremlinish if gremlins came out of your ass. And the cast does a pretty good job with the rather admittedly absurd story. It's got some funny moments, and it's got some gross-out humor in it. And, of course, it's got some shit and fart jokes. I guess your tolerance of this movie would depend on how well you tolerate things like that. It's kind of immature in its way, but it's still a good enough time passer. IMDb gave it a 5.7 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes at 58%, Letterboxd at 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5. Next up, we've got 2007's Planet Terror.
Say a prayer for your old man. No dead bodies for Dad tonight.
I got bit.
Bit by what?
If I told you, you probably wouldn't believe me.
They're not living.
What was that?
They're not dead.
The hell are the bodies?
They're gone.
They're not stopping.
The hell is going on?
Jerry.
Spread all over the world.
You want the story? I'll spin it for you quick.
We got a face full of DC too.
Where the laws of science are broken.
Right now the soldiers are turning.
Don't taunt me, Tramp.
Once that happens, they'll tear us apart whether they want to or not.
The side effect is terror.
I swore to my men that I'd do everything in my power to keep them alive. I never had a choice.
Now, the last hope for humanity.
I'm gonna go get Jerry.
Fine, but we're taking my car.
I'm riding with you.
Rests in the hands of a few.
I have no leg.
I made you something. Stand. Hop on. No, the other way. No, the other way.
In rural Texas, the go-go dancer Cherry Darling runs into her mysterious ex-boyfriend, El Rey, at the Bone Shack where she works, which is a restaurant owned by brothers JT and Sheriff Haig. Meanwhile, the demented Lieutenant Muldoon and his men make a transaction with chemical engineer Abby for mass quantities of DC-2, a deadly biochemical agent. When Muldoon learns that Abby has an extra supply, he attempts to take Abby hostage, causing him to release the gas into the air, mutating most of the town's residents into deformed zombies. The infected townspeople are treated by Dr. William Block and his unhappy, unfaithful, and bisexual anesthesiologist wife Dakota at a local hospital. Random attacks begin along the highway, causing El Rey and Cherry to crash. In the aftermath, several zombies tear off Cherry's right leg, and at the hospital, it's Tammy, the former lover of Dakota, who Black recognizes. Upon realizing Dakota was about to leave him for Tammy, he stabs Dakota's hands with her anesthesia syringe needles repeatedly, rendering them useless, before locking her in a closet. El Rey is then detained by Sheriff Haig, based on past encounters between the two. As the patients mutate, El Rey leaves the station and arrives at the hospital, attaching a wooden table leg to Cherry's stump. As El Rey and Cherry fight their way out of the hospital, Dakota manages to escape in her car. Meanwhile, Black becomes infected along with the others, while Cherry and El Rey take refuge at the Bone Shack. Dakota then retrieves her son, Tony, and takes him to her estranged father, Texas Ranger Earl McGraw. Dakota, Earl, Cherry's former boss, Skip, and Tony's crazed babysitter twins arrive at the Bone Shack. With Haig badly injured, the group decides to flee to the Mexican border before being stopped by a large mass of zombies. Muldoon's men then arrive, killing the zombies before arresting the group. Abby tells them that the soldiers are stealing the gas supply because they are infected, and constant inhalation of the gas delays their mutation. They also learn that some of the population is immune, hinting at the possibility of a cure. As Cherry and Dakota are taken away by two soldiers, the others defeat the guards. JT sustains a gunshot wound in the process while the group searches for Muldoon. When he is found by El Rey and Abby, Muldoon explains that he killed Osama bin Laden before he and his men were infected and were ordered to protect the area before being killed by Abby and El Rey. Meanwhile, Cherry is held at gunpoint and forced to dance by a soldier who threatens to rape her. Eventually, she breaks her wooden leg across his face and stabs him in the eye. Dakota, after realizing her hands have regained feeling, uses her syringe launcher to subdue another soldier, and El Rey and Abby arrive to rescue Cherry and Dakota. El Rey then replaces Cherry's broken wooden leg with an assault rifle. JT decides to stay behind to detonate explosives to eliminate the remaining zombies while the others flee. The survivors make plans to escape by stealing helicopters after fighting through a large group of zombies, but Abby dies in the process. While saving Cherry from a zombie, El Rey is fatally wounded, and Cherry, now sporting a minigun leg, leads survivors to the Caribbean beach at Tulum, where they start a peaceful new society during a worldwide zombie outbreak. It is also revealed that Cherry has given birth to her and El Rey's daughter. And then in a post-credit scene, Tony is sitting on the beach at a survivor's base, playing with his turtle, scorpion, and tarantula, and the movie ends. Released as part of the Grindhouse double feature, which combined this movie with Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, this is probably my favorite and the best out of the two movies. It has a fucking stellar cast, which includes Bruce Willis, Uma Thurman, Danny Trejo, Uma Thurman, I think I just said that, Josh Brolin, Rose McGowan, Freddie Rodriguez, and Tom Savini. It's a nice little blend of comedy, action, and drama, and it has some pretty good gore. I mean, some people die some pretty brutal and gruesome deaths in this, including one where Quentin Tarantino's character basically has his dick melted off. Yeah, there's some pretty gruesome shit in this. My only real complaint about this is that it was purposely made to look like it was being shown at a seedy 70s or 80s, grindhouse movie theater. So it comes with like lines across your screen and the picture jumps and goes out of focus every once in a while. And there's like acid burns on the side of the screen. And at one point in a scene where there's some major action going on, there's a scene missing card, and then it jumps having missed what was going on. which can really be annoying when you're trying to enjoy the movie. But that's really my only complaint about this. And it's definitely one I highly recommend that you see if you've never seen it. It's definitely not for everybody, but if you can stomach it, it's a good movie. This had a budget of $23 million, but was considered a flop, as it only brought in $10.3 million at the box office. IMDb rated it a 7.1 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 76%, Letterboxd a 3.3 out of 5, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5. And that leads us into 1994's Cemetery Man.
I don't know how the epidemic started. All I know is that some people, on the seventh night after their death, come back to life. I call them returners.
I've got a helper, Nagi.
On his ID card, it reads, distinctive visible marks, wolf. The most beautiful living woman I have ever seen.
The cemetery's small, but it's got a marvellous ossuary.
I don't want to. I can't.
Why on your poor husband's grave, huh?
You would have liked to know. Well, oh. Come on, this man's gonna just...
That's mine! He came back to the dead, he raped her, and then bit her to death.
Is it true what they say? That the dead come back to life here at night?
Go away. I haven't got time for the living.
How sweet.
Yeah?
No.
Please stop.
I'd like to bury
now. Not as long, dear, as I've got a breath in my body.
All right.
Somebody stole my crimes.
Make a wish.
I want you to fall in love with me.
Francesco Della Morte is a cemetery caretaker in a small Italian town of Buffalora. He lives in a ramshackle house on the premises, constantly surrounded by death, with only his mentally handicapped assistant, Nagi, for company. Young punks in town spread gossip that Della Morte is impotent, and his hobbies are reading outdated telephone directories in which he crosses out the names of the deceased and trying to assemble a puzzle shaped like a human skull. Nagi can only speak one word, and that's nah. Latin inscription over the Buffalo Cemetery gate reads Resurrectoris, which means for those who will rise again. And indeed, Della Morte has his hands full. Some people rise from their graves within 7 nights following their deaths as aggressive zombies. Della Morte destroys these creatures, which he calls returners, before they overrun the town, without anybody knowing what's going on. Buffalo's mayor is so fixated on his re-election campaign that he doesn't register Della Morte's pleas for an investigation into why the returners are coming back. Being an outcast in a village and almost illiterate, Della Morte doesn't want to lose his job, and he opens up to his only friend, Franco, a municipal clerk, but doesn't file the paperwork to get assistance. He explains it's easier just to shoot them. At a funeral, Della Morte falls in love with the unnamed young widow of a rich elderly man. She is won over when Della Morte tells her about the ossuary, which he adores. While consummating their relationship by her husband's grave, the undead, understandably upset husband arises and bites her. She seems to die from the bite, but the coroner claims it was a heart attack. Fearing the worst, Della Morte stays near her corpse and shoots her when she rises again. Nagi becomes infatuated with the mayor's teen daughter, Valentina, but she is tragically decapitated in a motorcycle accident. Undeterred, Nagi digs up her reanimated head and begins an innocent romance. The relationship is cut short, however, when Nemeyer finds out and Valentina rips out his throat with her teeth. Delamorte is forced to shoot her, and Delamorte is forced to shoot her. The young widow also rises again, causing Delamorte to believe she was not really a zombie when he first shot her, in which case it was he who killed her. He plummets into a depression and is visited by the leering figure of death, who tells him to stop killing the dead and suggests shooting the living instead. Delamorte encounters two more unnamed women, also played by the same one that played the unnamed widow. The first is an assistant to the new mayor. She confesses to Delamorte that she is terrified of sexual penetration, so Delamorte demands to have his penis removed by the local doctor. Refusing to do so, the doctor instead gives him an injection to induce temporary impotence. Well, meanwhile, the woman has been raped by and fallen in love with her employer. Having lost her phobia, she plans to marry her rapist and discards the cemetery man. His grip on reality now slowly slipping, Delamorte heads into town at night and shoots the young men who have made fun of him for years. He meets a third manifestation of the woman he loves, but upon learning she is a prostitute, kills her and two other women by setting their house on fire. His friend Franco is accused of these murders after killing his wife and child and attempts suicide. Delamorte then goes to visit Franco in the hospital, and sitting by the hospital bed, he casually murders a nun, a nurse, and a doctor. Franco claims to not recognize him, and distraught and confused, Delamorte screams out a confession, but is ignored. Nagi and Delamorte pack up their car and leave Buffalora. Nagi's head is injured when Delamorte slams on the brakes. They get out of the vehicle and walk to the edge of the road, where it drops into a chasm. Nagi begins to seize and collapses to the ground, and Delamorte realizes that the rest of the world doesn't even exist. Fearing his assistant is dying, he loads a gun with two dum-dum bullets to finish them both off. However, Delamorte cannot bring himself to shoot his friend, and Nagi wakes up, drops the gun off the cliff, and asks to be taken home, speaking clearly for the first time. Delamorte replies, nah, and as the credits roll, the camera zooms out to reveal the two men standing in a snow globe. This is another one that I talked about tonight that is rather bizarre, but I highly recommend seeing it if you can find it, as it is very hard to find a physical copy of it, and it's not available on any streaming services, at least not that I've ever seen. For a zombie movie, there isn't a lot of gore, even though there is a tiny bit, but if you're a zombie gore fan, this really isn't the movie for you. But it does have a nice bit of black humor, well, actually, a lot of black humor to it that's pretty funny, actually. And it's, if you can find it, it's definitely worth the watch. This was remade here in, the States in the early 2000s, I think, as Dylan Dog, Dead of Night. If you find that, only watch it if you're interested, because it's a really shitty remake and has nothing at all really to do with this movie, except for, well, I can't remember, it's been a long time since I've seen that shitty remake. And like I said, watch the original if you can find it, not the remake. IMDb gives a 7.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 61%, Letterboxd a 3.7 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. Next up, we have 2007's Teeth.
All right, what can I do for you, miss? Is this your first time? Okay. So I imagine you have no idea what to expect.
Not really.
Don't worry. I'm not going to bite you. Slide down. Put your feet right in here. Okay. Are you sexually active?
No. I just want to be checked out.
Okay, then. Okay.
I think there might be something weird going on inside.
Wes? Wes? What have you put in here?
There is something inside of me that's lethal. Dentata.
What?
It's Latin for teeth. It's what's inside me. Are you afraid?
This is too weird.
Just wait.
Don O'Keefe is a teenager spokesperson spokesperson for a Christian abstinence group called The Promise. She attends groups with her two friends Alicia and Phil. At home on several occasions, she hears her stepbrother Brad and his girlfriend Melanie arguing about Brad's refusal to engage in vaginal intercourse with her, insisting on only having anal sex. One afternoon, after giving a speech to a group about the purity ring worn by members of the group, Don is introduced to Toby, whom she finds attractive. The four begin going out as a group, and Don has fantasies about marrying Toby, although after acknowledging the attraction, they agree that they cannot spend time together. However, they later give in and meet at a local swimming pool. After swimming together, they go into a cave to get warm and begin kissing. Don becomes uncomfortable and tries to get Toby to go back outside, but Toby becomes more physical and aggressive. Don panics and tries to push him off, and Toby shakes Don, smacking her head on the ground and dazing her. Toby then takes the opportunity to begin raping her because he's a great fucking guy. Don fights back and inadvertently bites off his dick with her vagina. A horrified Don then flees the scene. Later, after a Promise meeting, she meets her classmate Ryan at a dance. They talk, and he drops her off at her home. Don then goes back to the swimming hole, and she screams in horror when she sees a freshwater crab crawling on Toby's penis. She drops her purity ring off a cliff, and she then researches vagina dentata and realizes that she may have it. She visits a gynecologist, Dr. Godfrey, in an attempt to find out what is happening to her. When he assaults her in the guise of an examination, reaching up inside her without a glove, she panics and her vagina bites off four fingers on his right hand. While biking home, several police vehicles pass her and she sees someone driving a car that looks like Toby's car. She then decides to go back to visit the pool to investigate, and when she arrives, she sees the police bringing up Toby's body, who presumably died of shock in the water. Meanwhile, back at home, her ill mother, Kim O'Keefe, collapses, and Don comes home and finds her, while Brad and Melanie are seen in his room having sex while Don's mother lies on the floor, and she is taken to the hospital. Don goes to Ryan seeking help, hysterical about her encounter with the doctor and her mother. Ryan gives her a sedative and masturbates her with the vibrator. Though initially afraid she will hurt him, she finds that when she is relaxed and consenting to the sexual activity taking place, her teeth do not engage. The following morning, they have sex again, but mid-coitus, Ryan's friend calls, and Ryan smugly boasts that he and the friend had bet on whether he could score with Don. In her anger, her vagina bites off his dick, and she leaves him to call his mother for help. Don's stepfather, Bill, attempts to throw Brad out, but Brad sets his dog on Bill, during which Brad confesses his love for Don. Don then meets her stepfather and Melanie at the hospital after her mother has died, and seeing her stepfather hurt and hearing from Melanie how Brad told her to ignore her mother's cries for help earlier, she becomes emboldened by her power and goes back home to seek revenge. Don puts on makeup and goes to seduce her stepbrother, and in the midst of the act, Brad recalls that while still kids, Don bit his finger, but it was not her mouth that had bit him. As he realizes this, Don's vagina bites off his dick, and she drops it on the ground, and although Brad calls his dog to bite her, the animal instead eats his dick, spitting out the genital-pierced glands. Don leaves him, and he presumably bleeds to death. Don then cycles away from home, but her bike tire sustains a puncture, so she begins hitchhiking. She gets a lift from an old man, but falls asleep, and rides for several hours, waking up after nightfall at a gas station. When she tries to get out, he repeatedly locks the doors. He licks his lips as if to ask for a sexual favor to release her. And Don hesitates and then looks towards the camera and the old man with the seductive smile as the movie ends. This is another one that is rather quite bizarre, but it's still also really good. It also flew under the radar of most horror fans when it was first released, because I don't think a lot of people knew what to make of Pussy with Teeth, to put it bluntly. But it's good, even though it is quite uncomfortable to watch, especially if you're a male, because, well, yeah, isn't everybody afraid of having their fucking dick chomped off? But it does have a good amount of comedy in it as well, especially when all these weird things start happening with Don's vag, for lack of a better term. But it's actually quite amusing. Not things that happen to Don, obviously, but the fact, or the whole movie, it's rather ludicrous. But like I said, it's funny, it's good, it has a tiny bit of gore, and can make your boyfriend uncomfortable if you're a girl. So, yeah, it's one you should definitely see. IMDb gave it a 5.4 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 80%, Letterboxd a 2.8 out of 5, and I give it a 3.8 out of 5. And that brings us to the final film of part one, and that is 1997's The Night Flyer.
One, zero, one, Bravo, Lima. Come in, over. I can't have you sitting in the middle of my runway. Respond, over.
Based on a short story of the same name found in the Nightmares and Dream Escapes collection by Stephen King, The Night Flyer focuses on Richard Dees, who is a cynical tabloid reporter whose motto is never believe what you publish and never publish what you believe. Merton Morrison, editor-in-chief at the tabloid Inside View, confides a case to him about a bloody murder in a rural airfield committed by a passing aviator who thinks he is a vampire and registered under the name of Dwight Renfield. Deeds refuses, but reverses his decision when two more murders are committed in another airfield, the victims drained of their blood. He recovers the case from Morrison, who in the meantime had entrusted it to the novice reporter Catherine Blair, and leaves in the footsteps of the killer aboard his own light aircraft. Dees gathers accounts, pays bribes, and even desecrates a grave for the purposes of his investigation. He senses that the case is stranger than it seems and receives messages telling him to stop his investigation. Dissatisfied with Dees' attitude, Morrison sends Blair to conduct her own parallel investigation, and Dees offers the young woman to join forces to hunt down the killer. They find his trail at the Wilmington airfield, and as he no longer needs her, Deez abandons Catherine to continue alone. He lands at Wilmington and finds Renfield's Cessna Skymaster with dirt inside and the interior covered in blood. The airfield seems deserted, but Deez finds several massacred people. After taking photographs, he goes to the bathroom to vomit and is surprised by Renfield, who reveals his face and turns out to truly be a vampire. Renfield destroys Deez's photographic film and forces him to drink a little of his blood, which gives Deez visions of all the victims coming back as zombies. In a trance, he attacks the bodies with an axe and is shot by the police officers who arrived on the scene with Blair. She sees Renfield get on his plane and take off, but adopting Deez's motto, she publishes an article that portrays Deez as the killer, and the movie ends. Now, this is one that really flew underneath horror fans' radars, especially Stephen King fans' radars. I believe it was only released as a TV movie. It has since been released on DVD and Blu-ray. But back when this was first released, it was just a TV, or a made-for-TV movie. So I don't think a lot of people saw it, but if you can find yourself a copy, it's, once again, is another one to watch. The cast, led by Miguel Ferrer, does an excellent job, and the fucking vampire makeup on Renfield is fucking terrifying. I mean, it's really creepy and scary. It kind of looks like a cross between a bat, a lion, and a human, for some reason, but it's definitely the price of admission just to see the makeup, because it truly is creepy and will freak you out. So, and like I said, this is one of the lesser known King adaptations, but if you can find yourself a copy, watch it. It might pop up on streaming services every now and again. I'm not sure about that, but I believe I've seen it on like Amazon and Netflix every once in a great while. So if you find it on there, watch it. And that just about wraps up part one for tonight. As always, you can reach out to me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. And that's it, guys. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. See you next time.